Look at all of our friends that are joining us. Very good. Phyllis Shapiro got stuck. She didn't get through the waiting room. I have to get somebody out of purgatory now. Okay. Let's just take a look for a moment and see who we have with us. Oh, we got a really good mix here tonight. We got a lot of people from Aguda Shalom and a lot of people I don't even recognize. Alana, you brought a lot of people in. Okay. Huh? There's my Bubby and Zadie. Always good to have you guys on. Very good. Just give a moment for everyone else to get through the floodgates. Okay. Good evening, everyone. My name is Moshe Kurtz. I work as the assistant rabbi at Congregation Aguda Shalom, which our Zoom account is hosting this. So I guess you could say you're virtually at our shul right now. I am joined with my colleagues, Rabbi Yair Lichman, Steve Gottlieb, and also we have Alana Bauman with us, who, in addition to being a remarkable individual who will introduce herself momentarily, she also, like to say, is a Rebbe at our Masifta here in Stamford, or as we call it, a teacher at our upper school. So without any further ado, Yair, what's our Seder Hayom? You want to give a quick overview of what everyone should expect this evening?
Sure. Thank you, Moshe. And thanks, everyone, for coming. It's a pleasure to see really a broad crowd here. In terms of how we're planning on conducting this conversation so that we get as many perspectives and voices possible while we're still able to hear each other through all the noise, we're planning on using the technological tools that we have to our strongest advantage. So for the first part of our evening, we'll be sort of carrying a semi-casual conversation among the four of us. But that doesn't mean that you'll be spectators in that process. We've had in the past and hope to have this week as well, very vibrant comments and conversations happening in the context of our Zoom room, or for those of us who are joining us on Facebook Live in the Facebook comments. So if you're hearing something that reminds you of an experience you've had, or you'd like to raise a question or a comment or a different perspective in the middle of our conversation, you are more than welcome to do so. We are strongly encouraged because that's how we get the chance to test our ideas against a combined might of this audience. We plan to open the floor after the sort of more formal part of our evening to, you know, the audio portion of our conversation as well, for people who have other comments and questions they'd like to share at the end. So you'll also see in the chat, which I'll post just now, a link to a Google Doc that just has some additional readings that I encourage you to not read now, but afterwards, some of the readings that are listed here are things that we've been reading in preparation for this conversation. So you're more than welcome to partake of those as well. We'll begin very quickly, but just briefly introducing ourselves, and specifically by presenting some of our background and experience in, I guess, non-exclusively Orthodox spaces. We'll define a little bit more what we mean as the conversation goes on. But we're definitely excited to share a little bit of our own personal experience and then get to fleshing out some of the issues as they come up. So I'll begin. My name is Yair Lechman. I currently teach Gemara at Westchester Day School in their middle school division, which is a modern Orthodox school. That is not my non-Orthodox experience. I think the most formative experiences for me that involve sort of reaching beyond Orthodox Judaism have been in a number of fellowships or programs I participated in while I was in my smicha at YU, at a number of organizations, probably too many to name right now. So my experience is largely with other, Jewish communal professionals or rabbinical students. And my interactions in those spaces were more as a peer and less as a professional. I think we may have different backgrounds here as well. So we're looking forward to hearing about that. Alana, why don't you take it away?
Sure. First off, I'll just say thank you all so much for inviting me to join you on this conversation. It's really a pleasure to be here with all of you together, especially after knowing all of you individually, or most of you individually, beforehand, and getting to be here together is really special. So hi, I'm Alana Bauman. I currently live on the Upper West Side, but I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, in a very classic modern Orthodox community, modern Orthodox day school, B'nai Akiva type of setting, with a very diverse extended family who we are very close with as a family. And that is probably the beginning of my experience in interacting with people who are not Orthodox, but also feeling very proudly connected to Orthodoxy myself. And I studied in Israel at MOY. Afterwards, I went to Brandeis University, where I got very involved in our Hillel on campus and our broader campus Jewish community, more on that to come. And I staffed birthright trips, worked for NCSY for a bit, and now I am teaching in the high school at the Cultural Hebrew Academy in Stamford, Connecticut. I teach science and Judaics to our high school students, and it is an outstanding place. And I'm also navigating finding my own personal community after college and figuring out what that's like. And that's also where some of these questions also come into play. And I look forward to sharing further. Thanks again for having me.
Steve?
Alrighty. Hello, everyone. It's nice to see so many faces, new and old. Thank you all so much for joining us. And thank you, Alana, for really joining this conversation. I am Rabbi Stephen Gottlieb. I'm a Kollel Fellow at Beit Midrash Zichron Dov in Toronto, as well as the Rabbinic Educator at the Village Shul / Eshet Torah Learning Center, also here in Toronto. But my experience in non-denominational and multi-denominational settings has really been my entire life. I grew up in Fairlawn, New Jersey, as a member of a family that was very, very active within the conservative movement. You know, you name it, USY, Camp Ramah, the whole nine yards. That was really my bread and butter. My first cousins were Reform, and we would very often go to their B'nai Mitzvah services, their confirmation services. We'd always see things in there. My uncle on my other side became Orthodox of a more traditional stream, and I myself ended up settling on modern Orthodoxy at some point, though I've really been through the gamut. When I was at Rutgers as an undergrad, I was on the board of the conservative and Orthodox communities, in addition to being on the board of AEPI, in addition to being on the General Hillel Board as the co-chair for pluralism and education. So this is really a topic that I'm really excited to be getting into from almost every area of expertise that I have. And I'll just close this little introduction of my own by just affirming the rumors that I spend all my time on Facebook, that I will be monitoring the Facebook comments on both my live video of this and Moshe's live video on this. So if anyone is watching right now on Facebook and not in the Zoom room with us, you are also a part of the conversation. Feel free to comment, feel free to ask your questions, and I will make sure that it gets a voice if it is within my power.
Well, Steve, it's good to hear that you settled on modern Orthodoxy. I wasn't sure there for a moment. We'll save that for another time. But actually, I like that Hashgacha Pratis would have it that we're juxtaposed, because my background, you might say, is the foil to what you have. I grew up in a very black hat yeshivish environment. So some people from where I grew up, they might say this very meeting is already interdenominational. And I think that's something that hopefully we'll discuss tonight, which is, you know, we don't want to get too much into it, but I think we have to discuss obviously where lines are drawn. You know, at what point do we call something outside of one's normative Orthodox space? But just to give you an idea of where I generally operate, I mean, similar to what Yair mentioned, you know, I did all the fun fellowships when I was in Smicha as well. I did the Federation Fellowship, the 92nd Street Y, Hartman, APAC, maybe something else I forgot at this point. But mainly in my day-to-day, you know, once you work in a community, especially outside the immediate in-town New York area, it's kind of passe at this point. You know, I do stuff with the Federation, I go to the JCC, I have a panel, which is actually interfaith with the JCRC tomorrow night on Zoom also. So, you know, I would say that I operate a lot in non-Orthodox spaces. And then hopefully this isn't controversial, I have to frame this properly. I work in an Orthodox shul, but we're also very proud to have many people who come who don't necessarily fit into the definition of normative Orthodox practice either. So there you go.
Yeah, Moshe, thanks for that. That's also a great segue just to a very brief definition of terms. It's, you know, always going to be, we may have to begin every session with this, but we're not here to define what orthodoxy means. Books have been written and books have been read, and that's not our job right now. We're not debating that kind of term. So what we mean when we say something like an Orthodox Jew in a non-Orthodox space, we're referring to a Jew who identifies as Orthodox, as a member of whatever that community means, you know, for them. In terms of non-Orthodox spaces, I'm actually going to sort of toss that out as a question for us to consider. I sort of broadly have in mind settings and spaces that are not being run under Orthodox auspices in accordance with Orthodoxy strictly defined. But more than that, I'm happy to hear different perspectives. And specifically, the way I would phrase the question is, what kinds of non-exclusively Orthodox spaces are there? And how are these spaces kind of different from one another? I know Alana had some thoughts in our pre-conversation. I'd love to start off with those.
Sure. Great segue. Thanks, Ayer. The way that I've been thinking about it, both before preparing for this conversation and also now solidifying it a little more, is defining non-Orthodox spaces in three main categories, and feel free to add on or subtract from those. The first is a pluralistic type of space, a space that is open and encouraging and supportive of all various types, flavors of Judaism, as some people call it. All different denominations are welcome. That might be something like a Campus Hillel that's really trying to support all the different Jewish denominations. The second group I would classify is something that is a not Orthodox group, but still denominational, meaning something that is a conservative or a reform or a traditional egalitarian, a reconstructionist, a renewal, something that is a space that is specifically defined by a denomination that is not Orthodox. And it's serving that community specifically, though others might be welcome to join it. And the third space that I would say is something that is non-denominational, which is similar to pluralism in that it does kind of allow for an encompassing of all denominations, but it also is not trying to satisfy everyone, in that it really is there to create its own sort of environment that might be a non-denominational school setting where everyone can feel comfortable being who they are. But it's not that we're trying to create a compromised space of all the places and all the different mindsets. How does that sound? What do y'all think about that?
Sounds like a good summary. I would add or ask, maybe, I know we don't want to get too nitty gritty on definition of terms, but I remember when I was an undergraduate at YU, before I did Smicha, I did an undergrad fellowship with NYU's Brafman Center called CLIP, which brands itself as the term pluralistic Jewish fellowship. But what a number of my friends and colleagues there recognized was pluralistic sometimes is code word for politically liberal in ideology. I could give specific examples if you like, but it might derail. So I'm curious what you mean by pluralistic, if you could expand on that.
Sure. If anyone else would like to take it, then please, by all means. We had this debate when I was at Brandeis about whether pluralism was actually something that was real or something that was made up in our minds and actually not achievable. A space that every single type of Jew could feel like they are being served and that their needs are also being met. And I think to some extent, and we should discuss this further, is that something that's attainable or not? But if it's okay, I'll describe one type of environment that was really the only space that I felt was really a pluralistic environment that I've been in at its finest. When I was at Brandeis, I took a class on Jewish education, and we went to visit a mikveh there called Mayim Chaim Mikveh. And this mikveh is really interesting. For anyone who's listening and doesn't know what a mikveh is a ritual pool of water that different people will immerse in for different life experiences. And I will leave it at that in a vague term for intentional reasons, because that means different things to different people. And this mikveh had the same exact body of water, and it served as an educational center as well as the mikveh itself. And you would go and you would say, this is the type of immersion experience that I want. And they would they would, I don't know, help you to have that Orthodox experience or that conservative experience or whatever it was that you were looking for. And it really served the moment that everyone was trying to look for. That's the type of thing that would be a pluralistic space where everyone can be served to some extent. Does that clarify?
I think that's a great example. You know, a distinction I might say is a mikvah, it could accommodate people based on, I'm not even sure how it looked different from one to the other, but I mean, maybe you're using a chatzitza when you go in. I'm not sure how it differed from one belief system to another. But I'll give you an example of maybe where pluralism might be more difficult to achieve. So I remember one time on this program I described, we had a Shabbaton. And to accommodate the Orthodox and the egalitarian interest, they devised a trichitza, where there was a men's section, a women's section, and anything you want, an egalitarian section. So the people in the egalitarian section felt it was a compromise on their values to be having some separation in their space. And the Orthodox people, myself included, we felt it was a compromise on our belief that there should be separate seating. And so the question that we debated was, well, can we be fully accepting and work in a cohesive fashion, but maybe there are certain things that just aren't meant to be compressed and squished together into one space. So that's a little more difficult, I think, than the mikvah question, perhaps. And that's definitely what I've experienced working in broader non-denominational or pluralistic spaces.
Okay, so Moshe, I'm going to sort of deliberately take us maybe not, you know, to use the words positive and negative here. But, you know, before we start talking about like obstacles or challenges involved in some of these spaces, let's talk about like why they exist or why they ought to exist. What are some of the benefits that, you know, we might have gained from, you know, those kinds of exposures? I'll briefly add to Alana's list. We could also talk about individual, like personal relationships outside of institutional settings. For our purposes, we've sort of framed this conversation a little bit more towards organizational settings, but we don't need to for the purpose of fleshing out some of the benefits of being in a, you know, being in non-Orthodox spaces, for lack of a better term. So I'll start and I'll say that the thing that I gained the most from some of those opportunities, broader exposure to the broader Jewish world. And again, just to frame, my experience in that world has primarily been as a consumer as opposed to as a service provider. I wasn't teaching in a you know, non-denominational setting. I was sort of benefiting from those settings as a participant in different programs. I found it really intellectually interesting. I thought that it helped me develop a much greater understanding of my own religious beliefs. I found that my own faith convictions were being strengthened or clarified by exposure to Jews with different beliefs than myself. And I think that sort of one natural benefit is the benefit of having any environment where people are able to respectfully listen to each other and debate each other. And that's the opportunity to learn. So for me, that's one, you know, key benefit and why one might seek a space like this. But I'll hear other ideas also. Steve, I'm going to
give a chance to Steve to talk. Yeah. Sorry to be on the spot.
No. It's fine. I think that they're really, the benefits of being in these kinds of spaces cannot be overstated. As you said, from an intellectual point of view, being able to clarify your own convictions in conversation with others, but also just being able to be exposed to a broader world. You know, Orthodox Jews, despite being, you know, appearing larger than we are in some places, really are a minority of Jews in the world. And being able to see how most Jews view their Judaism and interact with it is an incredible, incredible opportunity to understand that we are not in the same boat, and that if we want to have an impact on broader world Jewry, and I'm not talking about Kiruv here, I'm talking about just generally being able to interact with and explore what other types of Jews have to offer, we need to understand where they're coming from. We need to understand that they're human beings, that we're in the same room with them, and that we can be in the same room with them, and that we can have productive conversations and even intellectually stimulating arguments, l'shem shemayim, for good purposes. but we need to be willing to go into those spaces. We need to be willing to be in those rooms, because more often than not, they are not going to come into Orthodox settings, unless it's in a type of Kiru setting where it's going to be very controlled and it's going to be very limiting. It's also going to be very self-selecting. So being able to put ourselves out there is really the best way to understand there's so much more to Judaism than just where we find ourselves. And that gives us a tremendous opportunity, not only for being able to share our ideas with new people who wouldn't otherwise hear them, but to explore our own inner convictions and come to newer understandings of how we view ourselves and our Judaisms. So I really cannot understate the benefits of interdenominational work.
Moshe, do you want to go, or is it okay if I...
Alana, please. I'm going to have a very cynical take, so it's better you go first.
I'm going to go... I want to go last then, though, to leave us on a better note.
Never. Okay.
Oh, okay.
You know,
okay.
Like, how she made it, you know, end off on the positive.
I'm going to offer a few different examples of times I've experienced these types of spaces. Firstly, our Brandeis Hillel Shabbat dinner, where you would have 200 to 300 students in a room, all come from their various services that were happening before that to welcome in Shabbat, or they weren't coming from services at all together, sitting in a room, having Shabbos dinner. I don't think there is anything that needs to be explained for that other than that is a beautiful experience. Yes, there are conversations that can be had. It can be intellectually stimulating, but at the end of the day, there are like people who feel connected to each other on a deep level because they are sharing that same Shabbat experience, even if that looks different to them and means something different to them. And that innately has beauty to it with the unity that comes with it. On the Hillel board at Brandeis, and I guess we'll get into the challenges later, so I'll actually pause for that. But during the beginning of COVID, Hadar, which is a traditional egalitarian organization, did a lot of virtual programming, one of which was a Jewish wisdom fellowship in which they invited Jewish educators and lay leaders from across the country, maybe international, I don't remember, to partake in weekly sessions where we would learn Torah together and then discuss how they were relevant to the time that we were meeting in this COVID period and how we would serve our communities in that way. And much to my surprise, it was me and one other Orthodox person who happened to be a rabbi who were participating in that program along with many non-Orthodox Jews. And I found it very important that we were there, because if you're trying to get a group of people together who are representative of Jewish community leaders throughout the Jewish community at large, it's important that Orthodoxy is part of that. On a personal level, our community should be represented amongst those conversations and should be represented amongst those groups, not necessarily only because we have what to learn from other people or that we have what to contribute to other people, but because if something is claiming to really be a full spectrum experience or a full all-encompassing group, we should be putting ourselves out there to allow that to be true. Because if we don't put ourselves out there to be part of those groups, then as much as something wants to be pluralistic, as much as something wants to be all-encompassing, if we're not showing up as Orthodox Jews, it's just not going to be. So those are my two things.
Well, you briefly alluded to something I just have to mention. So one thing I read in preparation for the conversation tonight was this volume of the Orthodox Forum called The Relationship of Orthodox Jews with Believing Jews of Other Religious Ideologies and Non-Believing Jews, meaning a bunch of really qualified community leaders have already had the conversation that we're having now, but certainly there's something to be gained. And one of these essays is I thought a really cute vignette that I think illustrates a game you alluded to. It's from an essay by Sylvia Barak Fishman describing an experience that a reform woman had in one of these kinds of pluralistic spaces. This is a quote from that woman. "There were two Orthodox men on my mission. I had never spoken to Orthodox men before, and I was blown away. They were the most gentle, interesting, and non-sexist men of any religious persuasion I had ever met." So I think what's being alluded to here is the idea that being in these spaces also offers something to the spaces, contributes in a way that wouldn't be there before, and specifically helps with building relationships between communities between denominations in ways that can be helpful for other reasons that we haven't mentioned yet, and for dispelling stereotypes. I think the premise that the two Orthodox men were supposed to be the most sexist men of any religious persuasion that she had met was one that struck me as offensive, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to clarify that for others who might not realize.
But it's also an availability heuristic. The kind of people that will enter into those forums tend to be more moderate than their counterparts who wouldn't be willing to come to the table to begin with. I mean, I'm not trying to say that Orthodox men are all sexist, but what I'm trying to say is that it's a little bit of a selection bias, wouldn't you say?
I definitely agree. I think what it points to is potentially a responsibility to represent ourselves well. I'm seeing a private comment from someone who I won't mention the name because I don't know if he wants to be, mentioned this publicly. How was one not to hear that line? How was one to hear that line and not hear it as an offensive attack against Orthodoxy? It comes off as, oh, you're one of the good Jews. And I'm not sure that's wrong. I'm not sure what this woman had in mind. So we don't want to put words in her mouth. There are two ways to take it, right? One way to take it is, I thought Orthodox people would be sexist. I see these two who aren't. Oh, but they're one of the good, Orthodox men, as opposed to, the alternative, which would be, I thought Orthodox men would be sexist, but I met some who weren't, so maybe now I realize that my first intuition was wrong. And I don't know if everyone will take that second path, but if some people do, that's probably a benefit.
I definitely don't want to talk about sexism right now, but I will say that I had a very similar conversation on a more broad scale with my students. Earlier this week, we were talking about wearing things that make you look Jewish in public, and if that's something that you want. And as an Orthodox Jew, I said that I proudly wear my Jewish star necklace or my whatever type of clothing I wear that identifies me as Jewish, because I want to be identified as part of the Jewish community. And some people objectively do not want to be identified as part of the Jewish community for other reasons. And I think it's very interesting and maybe a different conversation to have of what, how are we portraying ourselves within our Jewish circle as Orthodox Jews amongst other Jews? Or how are we portraying ourselves as Jews like at large to the rest of the world? And is that something that we're looking into?
I see a comment that was posted publicly from Shifra Elman. I think sexism it sounds like a good discussion, but I think I trust Alana's intuition that it might be deserving of its own separate session. So we'll have to address that in a future episode, God willing. Yair, if it's okay, I want to actually address your question, which is what I benefited from non-Orthodox settings. And I'll do you one better. I'll tell you about the development of my opinion on it. So it started off, going back to my background, a nice yeshiva bacher from the Velt. And my first interdenominational experiences formally were really my first non-Orthodox, non-normative experiences at all. So this was me opening up to the world in general. And it was very enlightening just to hear people with different views, make me challenge my own assumptions, learn how to talk with people respectfully, even if I fundamentally disagree with them on the most important tenets of my faith and my religious beliefs. But after doing fellowship after fellowship, I remember, I think, Yair, the last one that we did together was the Federation when we were in Smicha. And I just remember, the Federation's wonderful. It just happens to be, it was like the fifth one I finally did. And I just remember thinking to myself, I'm thinking, if I'm going to be sitting around with people who I don't share the same beliefs with, and I'm not saying that they're bad people because they think differently than me. That'd be an immature way to think. But once I'm already trying to diversify myself and work with people and talk with people and interact with people who think differently than me, it just seems like an artificial line to draw that let's do interdenominational dialogue. I'd rather have interfaith at that point. Because if what we're emphasizing is that all human beings are wonderful, all human beings are beautiful, and all humankind should be able to come to the table and share their experiences and share their unique perspectives, it's just unappealing to me to only hear from within the self-identifying Jewish fold. I'd rather at that point, have a Christian, have a monk, have some, you know, an atheist, just have different people at the table altogether. So I'm not sure. I don't personally, I found it very underwhelming at a certain point to do things interdenominationally. Because what's the point of drawing a line there, just from an ideological standpoint, from an intellectual standpoint?
Yeah, so Moshe, I think the premise on which you and I might disagree is whether we think, I guess, how integral we see the connection between, let's say, Orthodox Judaism, whatever that might mean, and Jews of other ideologies. And we can make those, you know, comparisons on many grounds, right? We might argue, you know, halakhically, we have more in common with, you know, a conservative Jewish congregation than with Muslims, and that might, you know, motivate or justify more cooperation. We would argue that, like, philosophically, right, taking, you know, Rav Soloveitchik's covenant of fate in mind, right, the Jewish people are bound together, even if we don't all share ideological commitments, and that motivates certain kinds of connections. Or we could be, you know, cynical pragmatists, as I'm sure you would love us to be, and say, well, there's a lot of self-interest involved, that we have the opportunity to advocate for shared causes together. We have the opportunity to discuss things that only make sense to discuss amongst ourselves, that wouldn't make as much sense to discuss outside of our own Dalit Amot. So there are probably lots of, you know, sort of additional pieces that make interacting with, you know, other Jews, even, you know, this goes a little bit beyond already, but even Jews who might not identify as halakhic Jews, but who themselves identify as members of our community and who fight on the same team as us for some things, as opposed to otherwise. I'm just being mindful of time. I want to at least be able to divert some of our attention to challenges. What are obstacles? What are challenges? Things that a person might encounter in hitting those spaces for the first time, or for any time for that matter. And then sort of, you know, seeing those in light of opportunities we might try to integrate together. So let's shift our focus a little bit. I know Alana mentioned she wanted to talk about challenges on the Hillel board. But I'm happy for someone else to take those on some occasions or otherwise.
I'm happy for someone else to take this first, if you'd like.
I'm happy to take it first.
So I'm going to let you do that. I'll take it after you.
Alrighty. So I'm sure we actually probably have more to relate to in this regard. So I want to just say the golden standard of pluralism for me has always been Rutgers Hillel. Under the direction at the time of Andrew Gutierrez, who was a modern Orthodox Jew, now under the interim directorship of Rabbi Esther Reed, a conservative rabbi. And it really has always been the gold standard for me. They have conservative, Reform, and Orthodox rabbis on staff. Each of them have a minyan. Everyone comes together for meals. There were people in charge of pluralism, make sure people are actually integrated with each other. But the issue was that more often than not, it felt like three communities that shared a house rather than one community that had different options for davening. And despite attempts to mitigate that, I think it always naturally ended up falling that way, which leads to the big issue with pluralism. And from this, I'm going to borrow from an article. It's not in the reading group, in the reading document, but maybe I'll add it, by Rabbi Ethan Tucker with the Rosh Yeshiva of Mechon Hadar, where he has a pyramid model. And he basically lays out three values: community, pluralism, and integrity. And his basic claim, and I think this is true, is that you can only ever have two of the three at any one point. If you're truly pluralistic, it's going to be very hard to have a real community if you're integral with that pluralism. If you want a real community with integrity, it's going to be impossible to be pluralistic, and any combination thereof. And I think that's really a major problem, especially when you have organizations that claim that they want to be pluralistic, but really are not willing to put the work in for that. And here I'm going to share a personal story. This is a story I've only shared once in my experience. When I was in YU rabbinical school, I was invited to join a pluralistic rabbinical student retreat. A friend of mine who went to Yeshivat Chovevei Torah invited me to come join them. And YU was not one of the sponsoring institutions, so I didn't have an automatic ride. So I had to email. So I emailed the head of this retreat. And I said, hey, I go to YU. I think this would be really cool. Can I participate? And he said, sure. But you need to do XYZ religious thing. I'm not going to get into all of the details here. And I asked my main Rosh Yeshiva at YU, and he told me, you know, I'm sorry, I don't think that you can do it. I was very upset about this, but I understood why. So I emailed back and I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to in the end, but thank you so much for offering room anyway. And he sent me back this email, which I'm going to read because I think it's really important just to put cards on the table and highlight when these things go wrong. He said, "Dear Stephen, thank you so much for getting back to me. I understand your predicament and respect your decision. Going forward, you will have to examine whether the policies of the system of which you are a part advance the larger schlemut we want in the world or not. These are the decisions that will determine the kind of rabbinate you develop. Sincerely, insert name of rabbi here." And that was a real watershed moment for me in my time in rabbinical school, because it showed me that you can try so hard to build a real pluralistic space, but if there's someone who in good conscience says, I'm sorry, I can't go, this is against the line of my institution, instead of just wishing luck, to question whether that really contributes to broader shlemut of the Jewish people, to a broader perfection of the Jewish world, it betrays a not only lack of derech eretz, but a lack of confidence in the ability for pluralism to really work. Because true pluralism would allow room for those who disagree, or at least would allow room for respect for those with whom you disagree, without assuming that it goes against this broader situation. I don't share that for pity, but I share that because I think it highlights how hard it is to really be truly open to pluralism and everything that it means. He put the community and integrity over true pluralism. And for that, I'm sure it was a wonderful Shabbaton. I think there's someone in this Zoom who was actually at that Shabbaton. I'm sure it was a great time. But it really highlights for me that issue. At the end of the day, we need to be careful with these things. Pluralism, for it to work, needs to be extremely intentional. And my worry is that very often, the people and organizations who put this together aren't really opening up to a broader audience. I'll just give one more example very, very briefly, that there was a book that was recently put out by a collection of rabbinical students, and it highlighted the diversity of Jewish voices in America. And it had the authors from Hebrew College, Hebrew Union College, JTS, Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, Maharat, and there was no one from YU at all. And this was a person who I knew had access to people from YU, who I knew spoke with YU students in the past, who knew me personally. And I asked why there was no one from YU. And he responded, and he said, you know, that's a good question. That's something we did wrong. And next time we put this volume out, we're gonna make sure that we get someone from YU. Because the value of pluralism outweighs whatever it was that was blocking that from their immediate. So that's just all to say, pluralism is difficult, but if you put your mind to it and you put the intentionality to it, I think it's not impossible. It's just a matter of figuring out what parts of the pyramid to prioritize at any given meeting.
So Steve, I think you alluded to a very critical point, which is a lot of people who don't want to do pluralism, especially people from the right who don't want to do it to the left of them, is because it's seen many times as giving a haskama, you're giving an endorsement to the other individual. And so I don't remember the exact term. I think it's like the, what's it called? It's a threat of proximal similarity. I remember seeing some formulation that, you know, if I sit on a panel with a Christian pastor, no one thinks I'm giving an endorsement and saying that he's equally as valid as I am. But, oh yeah, exactly what you said, lifnei iver. So if I'm sitting down, however, with someone of a different denomination, it's not clear to everyone that I believe that orthodoxy is the only way to go, which personally I do. So that I think is a threat. And when you publish in the same book as someone and everyone has rabbi in front of their name, there you don't have that opportunity to give that nuance. A panel I find is easier. I've done interdenominational panels many times in the past. But at the beginning, I could always say, you know, I love you as much as any other Jew, but I don't keep all these extra restrictions just for fun. I do because I think orthodoxy is correct. It's not just like, you know, the same way I'm a fantasy geek, I'm also an Orthodox Jew. Now, I believe this is right fundamentally. And to imply that something else is correct is something that I think some of us who are in interdenominational spaces, I would say, at least for myself, I need to be more careful about that.
Sure. I'll share a little bit from my Hello Board experience also, just to piggyback off of this. As the president of a Hillel, you serve as the person who is there to support all different types of Jews on campus in doing Jewish. And that was what it said on our Hillel little sticker in the office, supporting Jews doing Jewish, whatever that means to them. And I firmly held by that, and still hold by that. And that did raise its challenges. When our Orthodox daily mincha minyan did not get a minyan, God bless our conservative friends who did not feel really comfortable davening in a service with a mechitza, but who came to make that minyan for us of 10 men, so that way we could have that. Would I have done the same for them if they needed 10 people to make a minyan in an egalitarian space? I don't think I would, and I would have felt uncomfortable in that space. And do I support them in running their service? Yes. Will I go run Torahs across campus so that way they can have what they need to make their prayer service happen? 1,000%. And everyone should have a point at which they are unwilling to compromise their own values. And I don't think that that needs to contradict pluralism. And in fact, pluralism is really the opportunity for us to respect each other's boundary lines while also being willing to interact with each other, even with those boundary lines in place. We had a Hillel retreat, a first year retreat, when I was president also. And we were trying to figure out what to do with davening. And a lot of these center around davening, only because that is a prime space where halachic conversation comes into play, because it is something that could be different amongst different communities. It's a little bit more well-known. And none of our services would have had a minyan, except for the Orthodox minyan. And we were trying to figure out what to do, because how would it be fair if the entire Shabbos Orthodox students were the only ones who were able to daven with a minyan? So while it doesn't need a minyan specifically, we decided that we would daven Kabbalat Shabbat together, and we would daven outside in a space that didn't require a mechitza, and we would stand in such a way that anyone could stand next to whoever they wanted to, and we would sing these Tehillim together to welcome in Shabbat, and then when we needed to become a space that required a minyan, we would enter our various settings of denominational prayer spaces and do our thing and rejoin together for dinner. And I don't think that was a perfect solution, and I don't know that there ever will be, right? This trichitza idea is not a perfect solution either. It does make everyone a little uncomfortable, but there's also something really beautiful about it that shows that we're trying, to create a space that we can share as much as we can. And to the point of the distinction that we were talking about before, of why sit amongst Jews who might be different than ourselves? Why not just sit amongst people who are different than ourselves? I think that that really is part of it, that we need to be willing and able and putting ourselves at the table to sit amongst our fellow Jews. Those are our fellow Jews, they're our family. And while we may do things, we may think of things a little differently, at the end of the day, there's beauty to what they're doing, and there's what that we can learn from what they're doing. I have a personal challenge I'd love to share also, unless anyone wants to talk more broadly and institutionally beforehand.
You can finish first.
Okay. A few years ago, 2 years ago, I think, whatever was the February before COVID started, Machon Hadar, which has come up a lot in this conversation, so that's fun, does this, they have a branch that is called the Rising Song Institute, where they have beautiful nigunim that are produced from this institute, and they have a conference in February every year. They did it virtually this year, where they have Jews of various walks of life all coming together to learn, to sing, to engage in song together for a few days. And it was one of the most powerful experiences of my life, to be in a room of 300 people, 300 Jews of various walks of life, all there singing together the exact same Hebrew words, the exact same nigunim, the exact same melodies that we had just learned together in the room. And I left that conference feeling very torn. And I am very much a proud Orthodox Jew and very committed to my halachic lifestyle. And I left there really questioning if I would prefer to be part of the Orthodox community, or if I would be preferable for me to be part of this traditional egalitarian Hadar community that really was able to uplift me spiritually in a way that I hadn't experienced in an Orthodox prayer space in a very long time, in an Orthodox singing environment in a very long time. And I was speaking with a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, who I think many of people here know. I appreciate the the commonality there. Thanks for saying that, David. I was speaking with a friend of mine, and he said, you know, you can love that part of the Hadar community and be a part of Hadar in that aspect and not take on everything that they're doing. In fact, you can even bring part of that back to your Orthodox community. And for some reason, it hadn't dawned on me that we didn't need to be this or that, but that we could take from the different denominations and the different ways of practice and the different beautiful things we see amongst each other, learn from them a little bit, find our points of connection a little bit from them, and then make that our own unique experience within the box we choose to put ourselves in. If we're leading meaningful lives that are observant, then if I'm taking some spirituality and some spiritual uplift from a community that I may not call my own halachic community, is that so bad? And more than that, isn't that beautiful? Isn't that what having this big round table is all about? I'll pose that question.
I just want to add briefly to what Elena said. There's an interesting article by Rabbi Avi Weiss about Kiruv. And he actually says he doesn't like the word Kiruv, he prefers the word encounter. Because when you as an Orthodox Jew interact with a non-Orthodox Jew, you should be learning something from them too. And I want to actually put that in conversation with an idea I think is very powerful. And that's that I don't think it's easy to understand what we really believe until it's been challenged and we've had to re-articulate it in response to that challenge. And I acknowledge that that's a very difficult thing to say. It's not something I would prescribe for people whose faith is particularly fragile. But I know I never felt more confident in what I believed and what I want to see in the Yiddishkeit that I spread in the world than after moments of serious, significant interaction with Jews who had very different perspectives than me. Not only because it gave me an internal doubt that I had to then overcome, but because it helped me to articulate what I think and really believe it in a way that was active instead of passive. And I think making that into a real encounter, being open to that kind of conversation with others, is so important for people whose spirituality can handle it.
So that's an interesting take. It sounds like you're in contrast with Elana. Elana is saying, I want to take what they have to offer. And you're almost like, they're the Hechi Timsa. They're the means for me to better understand my own beliefs rather than take it from them.
So I'll say also, and this is in the reading documents, there's a powerful article by Rabbi Shmuel Golden, who's now the rabbi of Nefesh B'Nefesh. He was previously a shul rabbi in Englewood, New Jersey. And he actually gave that speech at JTS. And he called it an Orthodox rabbi's view of pluralism. And he articulated a difference between valuing and validating. You know, I think everyone in this room struggles with this idea of giving validation to something that Orthodoxy does not subscribe to. However, that doesn't mean we can't value them. And it doesn't mean we can't learn from those values and take those values into our own experience, making not only ourselves better, but also bettering the Orthodox community as a result of the values that we've learned and the values that we've adapted within that. So I think it's very important to understand there are things we can respect, there are things we can love, there are things we can treasure, and there are things that we can adapt in ourselves and truly value, not only superficially, but seeing another human being as a human being, as a Jew with something special to offer to the world, something unique, something powerful, and value that without also giving validation to a lifestyle that our particular branch of Orthodox Judaism cannot countenance.
So I would maybe push back on just one point. Sorry if I could just jump in there quickly, because I see there was a comment that's relevant to what I wanted to say. Avi Hoffman brought up about the tshuvas of the Roman communities, where they would go into churches in order to learn from the nigunim, so to speak, that the Catholic Church used. And again, just from my own perspective, once you're leaving Orthodoxy behind, it's all the same category for me from an intellectual standpoint. So it reminded me of that. Now, he pointed out that there's a controversy there about taking Christian music. The Roman community said it's okay. Most Achronim vilify them for doing that. But just the other point you made, Steve, was taking from the values of others. That's actually where I would personally draw the line. I think learning from musical styles from others, learning from different techniques, different community building strategies, when it comes to pragmatics, which are universal ideas, I don't see why you can't learn that from anywhere. But I think values is the one thing, values and beliefs is the one thing that actually is the dividing line. And once one's taking values from outside of, from my perspective, outside of orthodoxy, then you are no longer purely with traditional rabbinic Jewish values and beliefs. So that that's where I would personally draw the line. But Alana, it sounded like you wanted something to say. I'm sorry if I cut you off there.
I just want to respond to Rosanna really quickly, really quickly. I'm so sorry, Alana, for cutting you off. I didn't mean to.
No, you're fine. I was going to say something about what you said previously. Please continue.
Okay, fine. So I'll just say this really, really quickly, and then I promise, you know, I won't speak for another 10 minutes. But I just want to respond to Moshe. I think there's a difference between valuing and taking values. If that wasn't unclear in what I said, so I apologize. But I do think Moshe brought up a good question to think about in terms of music. And something that I've been thinking about, for example, very recently is that Hadar, and I know we've mentioned this a million times, take a shot every time you mention Hadar in this conversation. But they have a really, really great way of making really interesting liturgical music that is really, really cool and takes so many different styles into account. And I always wonder, you know, maybe it would be better for us to start using those tunes instead of Karl Bach. I don't have a good answer for that. I personally don't think we should be using Karl Bach tunes at all anyway. But what to replace it with is an interesting question.
But it's Zivura, of course.
And I wonder if it's something to think about. But I haven't fleshed that out. I just want to raise that question.
I'll add to that. I think that the music that comes from Hadar or from various types of Judaism, not just the Karl Bach or classic Orthodox artists, isn't only beautiful because it has stylistic differences, but Eitan Katz has this whole thing about every, and Joey Weisenberg has the same thing, that every time you sing a niggun in a different way, you're able to understand what it means a little differently, the words a little differently. That's a different value to the prayer that you're saying. And that's something that we learn from various walks of observance. I mean, what's the tune that we all sing for Havdalah? Like, I'm not going to sing it right now, but the one where you're all your arms around each other and there's the giant Havdalah candle, right? Like, that's not an Orthodox tune, but it adds significant meaning to the prayer that we're saying. Is that not a value that we're taking from something that is not Orthodox or a community that is not Orthodox? This in-depth feeling that comes along with that prayer.
I think this might turn into semantics, if I may. I think we're using values, the word value differently. That might be it. I'm all for, one of my greatest religious experiences was watching Les Miserables. But I'm not saying, you know, when I say values, I mean, you know, your theological beliefs, your understanding of how halacha works. But yeah, I think finding value in a musical uplifting experience that's not from our immediate community, I would side with you, Alana. I think that's, you know, you could find that at Hadar. They're doing very unique things. It's personally not my cup of tea, but I understand they're doing something unique and I'm all pro that. I think we're just using the word values differently, possibly.
The informal moderator of this informal conversation, I do want to note that we are past our time. And so that doesn't mean the conversation has to end, though it does mean that I have to leave. But I want to thank everyone who's here, including the fellow conversationalists in the various chat forums and live. A lot of interesting perspectives. This past debate, I think, was very interesting. I guess I leave it to those who are here now, whether you want to open the floor to, I guess, a more broader kind of conversation and questions, or if there are other points to raise. But I will duck out now before the decision is made. Thank you, everyone. I'll be catching up on the rest of the conversation a little bit later. Have a great evening.
Thank you so much, Yair.
So I'll just want to say one thing, Jose. I apologize before my 10-minute quota. But just to maybe end my formal part of this with another story from Rutgers Hillel of both emphasizing the challenge of pluralism, but also aiming for hope. When I was the co-chair for Pluralism and Education, alongside Gilana Lavovi, who I don't think is here with us, but she really deserves a shout out, we actually faced a very difficult challenge. Because that was the year that the treasurer of Rutgers Hillel decided that he wanted to propose an amendment to cut the pluralism and education position from Hillel, because it was wasting them too much money. And we spent half a year going through the records of Rutgers Hill events from momish the past decade, putting on a spreadsheet to show how even though the pluralistic events at Rutgers Hill consistently got less people than the other denominations, it always got a near even split from people within denominations being with each other in the same room, talking about Torah and sharing an experience in a way that no other groups within Hillel at all were able to accomplish consistently. And we presented that at the Rutgers board meeting, and unanimously, except for the treasurer, they voted to maintain the position on Hillel board, and it's continued ever since. So there are definitely institutional challenges with the support of pluralism from all sides. There are definitely issues with getting it in practice to work in an ideal way, but there's also hope for it to be able to really survive and maintain its presence, and I think really provide a net value for the entire Jewish community, people of any denominations, Orthodoxy included. On that note, Moshe, did we want to start taking questions?
Yes. Alana, do you still have time for, how much time do you have, Alana? We don't.
I'm good.
Okay, so why don't we, you know, we'll pull the plug at 8:45. How about that? Steve, that's good for you also? Okay, it looks like Dr. Reuven Herzog has been waiting very patiently there. Let's get him on. Asking you to unmute.
I appreciate the unnecessary and undeserved title. It's always fun to listen to peers and colleagues speak in this capacity. And
don't you feel like we're on the fifth floor of Gluck again?
I think we would have been speaking a little bit more fast and talking over each other a little bit more.
And I wouldn't have been there. Big thing.
Also, no, it's Steve. The library. The library was a good haven.
Without waxing into nostalgia, I want to just raise a bit of food for thought. I don't know if you need to address this right now, but a lot of this conversation about, I guess, I would maybe reframe it as modern Orthodox Jews in left wing liberal Judaism spaces. And my hunch is that this conversation could be very, very similarly had in regards to modern Orthodox Jews in ultra Orthodox or Haredi spaces, as in those who similarly have a different set of cultural norms, of ideological premises, and also to a large degree, a different approach to halacha, if not entirely a different set of halacha. I'm wondering if you guys think that if in your experience or just in your thoughts, if the conversation would play out in a similar capacity, or if it really is a different ball game, and or if you want to get even more meta, like, why don't we have that conversation as much? Why is it not as popular to talk about in the intellectual welt? So you can tackle any part of that if you want.
I just didn't fully understand the question. Before Alana goes, I just want to make sure we all understood the question. You're saying, why don't we talk about like people to the right of us in terms of being in their spaces? Was that the question? Oh, I have to unmute him again.
The question is like, we're talking about how do Orthodox Jews operate or relate to in liberal spaces? I think it's a similar, like, I think it should be a similar question and conversation of how do modern Orthodox Jews act and relate and value in Haredi spaces? I'm curious if you agree with that statement or have other comments on that angle, right? Like, yeah. Instead of just like looking, how do we view ourselves to the left? How do we treat ourselves in the border to the right?
It's interesting, Reuven, because in our preparation for this conversation, we created a semi-outline, like very, very small outline of this conversation of what we could cover. And that was the thing that showed up more in our written notes, but it is totally not what showed up in our outward conversation that just happened. So that's very fascinating that you say. And even in my list of experiences that I was writing out, that didn't show up. But as you're saying it right now, I do have experiences like that that have been very valuable. When I was at MMY, we we made sure to spend Shabbatot in various different Orthodox communities. And maybe that's the difference here, that they are possibly a Haredi community or a Hasidic community might still be under the realm of Orthodoxy. And maybe that's not why it's brought into the conversation as readily here, maybe. But we spent a Shabbos in Bnei Brak, and a lot of my religious meaningful experiences have been around song and singing. And we went to a tish with the Rebbe. And as you can imagine, a bunch of seminary post-high school women are attending this tish with the Rebbe, and we're all sitting up top on a balcony as the men are sitting below on their bleachers surrounding the Rebbe, all singing and dancing and eating the food and whatever. And it's a beautiful experience. And you're right. I could have been sitting there saying, this is really frustrating that I can't be a part of it. And I also could be sitting there saying, you know what? This is not my community that I am a part of every week. I'm currently putting myself into someone else's community to experience what it's like. How am I going to take that right now? And for me, it was a really beautiful experience to watch other Jews doing something with so much fervor and passion and excitement, even though it was antithetical to what I think, because if it was the way that I would want it to be run, I'd be right down there in the middle with them. But it was also a beautiful experience of religious life that I hadn't seen before, that was definitely in a different type of observance than my own, but still something very beautiful and should be part of this conversation. So thank you for calling attention to that as well.
So I'll just share, in addition, as a modern Orthodox Jew who is often the token modern Orthodox Jew in Haredi spaces, you know, as I said, my shul it's not an RCA shul, it's not a YU shul, it is an Eshet Torah shul. I'm the token YU rabbi on the staff. Our posek of the shul is the Aguda Rav in Toronto. It is not the, you know, YU Rosh Kollel. And for all intents and purposes, questions about how the shul is run are answered by the Haredi community. And it sees itself as part of the Haredi community in Toronto. As far as from a psak, from a policy perspective. And so as a result of that, I find myself in Haredi spaces very, very frequently. And I think it's important to recognize two things. The difference between being in a Haredi space and being in a completely non-Orthodox space, number one, is that there are much less halachic issues, if any halachic issues, that come to play. There are ideological differences that come to play. You know, I was in a Haredi shul a few Shabbos ago, and I was one of five people in the room who were masked. And that was a very painful experience for me. And I actually left before the end of davening because I could not justify being there. I have been in Haredi spaces where I've overheard conversations about race, about gender, about you name it, and I've been very turned off. But because halachically there was a shared Dalet Amos, it was much easier to be able to have a conversation started and be in the same room from the get-go. Part of it is because on Shabbos I dress more Haredi, and I wear a hat, I wear a black jacket, whatever it may be. But really, I see it as a little bit different than that, because even though the ideological differences are in some ways sometimes as big, I would even venture to say, as the ideological differences between, you know, Orthodoxy and the next closest to the left, the halachic differences are so minor that it becomes much easier to get a literal foot in the door and have those conversations. But I think you're right to point out, from an ideological point of view, there are differences at play that need to be thought about very, very seriously.
So, Alon, did you have a counterpoint?
Share for this question if you wanted to. Don't move on to the next one yet.
Oh, yeah. So I'm just going to share my perspective on it. So I think, you know, what Alana, you raised, and a number of people in the group, is that naturally modern Orthodox and anyone to the left and women are going to find it more jarring when they go into the Haredi community than people of my gender would. So obviously we have to acknowledge that. I think you spoke well to it. For me, I mean, I don't feel so particularly out of place because I grew up in the Haredi community. And I think, Steve, you made a good point about the fundamental halachic beliefs are the same. Now, you know, I think from what I found in the Haredi community, sometimes they'll be like, well, if the Mishnah Berurah says it, then that has to be it. Or if Moshe says it, then like, who's this posting from Israel? So they're much more into, you know, obviously the Das Torah and they don't like more mekel or particularly minority opinions coming out of nowhere, even if they're from Yush Talmidei Chachamim. If they're not on like the Moetzes Gedolei Torah roster, then they're not in equal standing. But I think, you know, obviously I was critical to people who are ideologically to the left of me. I have the same critiques for those who are ideologically to the right of me, in particular, because fundamentally I think adherence to traditional rabbinic Judaism's conception of halacha is the most important point that binds together orthodoxy. I think we should reopen the case on Hasidim for davening past the Zman in the morning. And dancing on Shabbos, I think also it's against an explicit mission on Beitzah, and the justifications for it are not so good. I'll share with you an article on that later, but it's not so good. So I think certain things got accepted on the right, which really shouldn't be, and that's open for review also. Now, I don't think I'm ready to say that they're... Well, certain practices I think wouldn't fit within orthodoxy, and I find that problematic. So yes, David, I'm a killjoy. That's what I'm here for. Someone needs to play that role tonight.
Yeah. I just want to add really quickly in response to a comment by Shifra Elman. She's 100% correct that when I was talking about the differences, it's very minor for men. For women, as you said, Moshe, and as Alana also said, it really is a world of difference. And I just want to share very quickly. Now, when I was first transitioning from traditional egalitarian Judaism, which is really what I would consider myself being raised within, to orthodoxy, for me, there was next to no differences that I saw. The liturgy was almost exactly the same for me. I was still able to lead davening, which was something I did frequently. I was still able to read from the Torah. I was still able to get aliyot. I was still on the same side of the room as the Aron Kodesh. There was no differences that I experienced personally. And it was really, gender was an afterthought for me in that transition. Were I a woman, I question whether or not I would have been able to become Orthodox in the first place based on the experience that I would have had. And I think that that's something that we need to wrestle with, not only when it comes to interdominal spaces and understanding that there are certain people who will not be able to get the full experience in other situations. So you can't just assume, oh, if they were only Orthodox, they'd be happy. That goes also for members of the LGBTQIA+ community, by the way. But I think it's just relevant to know, because as Orthodox Jews who will be in those spaces, be interacting with those people, we can do better at humanizing and understanding that, you know, the experience that I have as Steve Gottlieb jumping from denomination to denomination is very different than Ilana would have had in the same boat.
Yeah. Just one other.
I've been in that same boat.
Yeah. No, Ilana, go.
Sorry. I've actually been in that same boat in a similar way, different way. But there are multiple shuls in Silver Spring, Maryland. The shul that my family chooses to daven at for Mincha Maariv on Shabbos is one of the ones that's right across the street from our house. And usually at that time, I am the only woman who is there amongst a slew of black-headed men who are lovely, lovely people who I have rare interactions with. And that is one type of environment where I both feel very comfortable and also very uncomfortable at the same time. And on the flip side, I've davened in a conservative minyan before to support my friend who was having her bat mitzvah on campus, and I wanted to be there to show my support to her. And that was also in a similar but very different way, a comfortable and very uncomfortable experience. There's definitely a lot to unpack in terms of gender and experience of prayer. And that was one of our supposed topics that we decided not to get into for tonight, but maybe another time.
It
looks like we need to. And if anyone wants to talk further about it, I'm definitely very, very passionate about it and would love to. That's not what I wanted to say, though, if it's okay. I've just heard it come up a number of times, so I just need to say it. I think we might have a faulty understanding of denominations. We oftentimes will speak about denominations. This one is more to the right than me, or this one is more to the left than me. And while that is colloquially how we'll often refer to it, I don't know that denomination is a sliding scale spectrum like that as much as observance or religiosity is. Meaning, some might say orthodoxy is more to the right than conservative Judaism, but I promise you, I have some conservative friends who are much more observant than some of my orthodox friends, and I would consider those people more to the right than I would the other. So I'm not sure that I think we should be careful with our language to represent denominational Judaism, not as a spectrum, but more as a different ways of observing things. I don't know what the alternate geometric shape would be.
Agreed. I think that that's a really important point. It's not just a, you know, a smooth spectrum where you slide from one to the other. Just one other ha'ara I wanted to share, and I see David said it's been waiting for a while. I'll just share one last ha'ara, is to Reuven's point about analyzing how we feel about those who are to the right of us. I know this is oversimplifying, but it's a bit of a hakira in modern Orthodoxy that Steve and I had an exchange over a few summers back, which basically can be can be boiled down to, as a modern Orthodox Jew, do you see yourself as the left, all the way to the left of the Haredi world ideologically, or do you see yourself as all the way to the right of the liberal Jewish world? And depending on where you find yourself in that hakira, in that dichotomy, might answer how much you feel at home in the Haredi world. Just one other thing is that we haven't talked about discourse level. I know this is going to sound really snobby, and I apologize. I know that I'm making myself out to be this terrible snob tonight. And maybe I am, But I've had enough experience that I can say, with the exception of a few individuals, I'm talking overall in our generation, I can't go over to a colleague of mine from the Hebrew Union College, from the Reform School, and say, you know, like, hey, let's talk about Kim Leben de Rav meeting. You know, like, what do you think? What do you think about like a hutra dechuya? So like the education, we're not studying a lot of the same things. Now you move to the conservative, you know, you will find people who are learning Mishnah Brura and it's different, but we're just overall studying different things. And the discourse level, frankly, is just not the same. And you know what? Maybe a Haredi guy will make the same. In fact, they do, by the way. They make the same indictment about modern Orthodoxy. When I was deciding to go to YU, which is a radical left-wing decision for my from my place where I grew up, they're like, YU? Do they even like they learn Gemara, but they don't learn like a Tosis or Ritva there, do they? So, you know, that was a misconception on their part, but I think that's true. And I've been in many international learning spaces. I gave you the whole list at some point, but you'll have to take my word.
There's definitely a difference in curriculum in terms of what's being learned. In different smicha programs for different denominations, but I do think it's not fair to say that you wouldn't be able to discuss a certain topic with someone who is not in an Orthodox smicha program or with Orthodox upbringing. Maybe they would call something different. Maybe they would need a little bit more of a background. I don't know, but I don't think there's any reason to not be able to discuss it. I just wanted to, I don't think you were saying that. I just wanted to clarify it.
I think every human is capable of learning anything they want pretty much. But what I'm saying is Lemaisa, it's just not the same content. It's not the same content. I'd almost be happy if there was, you know, if our biggest difference, sometimes I'm like, you know what, let's disagree on documentary hypothesis. But like, I just want to be able to have the same, like, be on the same wavelength that we could talk about a Shach and Taz and talk about a Rav Chanan Wasserman and a Rav Baruch Baer. You know, that's almost how I feel sometimes.
I think you should have another conversation with smicha students from various rabbinical institutions and then conversation. Yeah. I don't think
That's fair. That's fair enough.
Yes. Yeah. I just want to make two ha'aras on Moshe's most recent point. Number one is just to say, and this is really, I think, an indictment of certain things within the Orthodox community that we need to work to correct. But there are many, many people in non-Orthodox rabbinical schools, and I say people dafka, of all genders, who grew up Orthodox and left and are passionate enough Jews that they're in rabbinical school. And I just always wonder, if they didn't leave Orthodoxy, what great things could they have given to the Orthodox community? But something somehow made them, maybe they were predisposed to, maybe there was some kind of, you know, traumatic experience. I don't want to discount those experiences. But maybe there was something that we could have done better to keep them in the fold, and Orthodoxy would have been better for it. And there are a lot of those. I know many, many, many people from Orthodox backgrounds who went to other rabbinical schools and are now doing very, very good things within the non-Orthodox communities.
I also think there's a big question we can ask of not just like, what could they have done in Orthodoxy if they had stayed, but also what opportunities would they not have been able to have within Orthodoxy? Right. And 100%. They were leaving, and now they have an expansive opportunity open to them to be able to do things to contribute to the broader Jewish community in the world. 100%. Again, a different Jason, you should totally have this Spiha talk. I'm really into it. Wish I could contribute.
That's fair.
The
you know,
horror Spiha, that I had. David. Sorry, the second horror.
Okay, then we go to David right afterwards. He's been waiting very patiently. So yeah, after your horror.
Sorry, the second horror that I had, just really quickly to Moshe's point. This I actually agree with him, is that I do think that there is a big cultural divide between Orthodoxy and what some people call non-Orthodoxy, some people call liberal Judaism, whatever it may be, whatever term that Jews who are not Orthodox want to use for themselves. I don't want to put a term in their mouths. But I do think there is a difference. You know, I heard someone saying in the wake of Trump's election as president, you know, I don't understand why Orthodox Jews who are unhappy with this don't just come to our Reform Shul. We welcome them with open arms. All they have to do is be willing to daven in our sanctuaries, but you know, we'll support them. We let them be religious. And they didn't understand that there were people with a real legitimate, like, not only halachic, but theological issue being in those spaces. They assumed my space can easily tack on to them. It's just a personal choice that they need to make. And I think that that's a category error that often happens. Likewise, you know, Orthodox Jews will assume that, oh, they can just flip a switch and become Orthodox because they really know they should on the inside. I don't think that it's easy to make those arguments one way or the other. But I think it often prevents real dialogue. And that's true not only in terms of that example, but in terms of scholarly questions as well. I had someone block me on Facebook for trying to argue based on secular academics, not even based on Frum academics. You can argue that the Torah is all one source as opposed to four or five of them and still be taken seriously in the world of biblical scholarship, even if it's a minority opinion. And they said, no knowledgeable person would think this. How could anyone even imagine it? You're a fundamentalist if you believe that, and blocked me. So I don't know who the real fundamentalist was there. But I think Moshe was correct that there often are these category errors that happen. And I think both sides can do better to avoid that.
Shpeach. Are you guys fine if we move on to David Celis, as we're already in overtime, Shiva overtime?
This is so fun. It's like the football game last night. We could do this all night. Yeah, also, no, I just made a football reference. For anyone who's watching, I made a football reference.
You assume that, oh, I guess they got it. I don't understand football.
Steve and Ilana made the like 10 Hadar references. I am putter from doing that role.
Aren't you here in an official capacity representing Mechon Hadar? You're not?
No.
Oh.
I'm in official capacity as me, myself, and I.
Important disclaimer.
So the question I had is kind of for all three of you, but especially Steve and Ilana. Moshe, you mentioned how it feels like, and there's both the halachic, ideological, can we, should we horse trade to daven together? But what I think from my own experience bouncing around communities, maybe the bigger question is what you got at, Moshe, in terms of, I don't really care necessarily to talk about Bibkrit or can we daven together. I want to talk like Shach Taz, Daf Yomi Rashi Al HaTorah. And I wonder, especially for Steve and Ilana, who spend time in a lot of different spaces, how much you think part of this is a question of that, you know, within the Orthodox community, we have more or less a shared textual language. Like we know what, you know, this daf of Megillah is give or take, leaving it. And I know there's a lot of gendered stuff, but fine. You know, Rashi al HaTorah, a famous one. And like, if I step into HUC, they might know this, but you can't make the assumption. I wonder how much of this is also about communal code, that just the way this conversation went, we can drop certain phrases that assume certain knowledge in the minute you shift outside one space. You can't do that. And I'm wondering for you two, what your experience of kind of the questions of shared textual knowledge and frames of references in terms of how it plays into pluralism.
I have a relatively short answer, so I'll just take it first. It's a very, very public knowledge that I took Bechinas and got into both YCT and YU for Smicha. And the Bechinas were very different. YU was you prep Gemara Rashi Tosfos for a morning Seder and then answer questions with the person giving it. And YCT's was learn Gemara Rashi for a few minutes and read it. Read an obscure pasuk and translate it from Tanakh for us. Give a Devar Torah and have a really in-depth interview. And it was very, very different styles of going that. And the curriculums are very, very different. You know, Chovevei is much more focused on pastorals than YU. YU, it's an option. You know, I have a counseling certificate from FERCAL, the YU grad school of psychology, in conjunction with REITs, but it's not part of the core curriculum there. It's really much more focused on Gemara Halacha. And that means that there are Gemaras that I learned during Smicha that I'm sure that I could talk with a friend of mine from YCT about, and they wouldn't necessarily be able to follow. At the same time, if a yeshiva bacher from Neri Yisrael or Chafetz Chaim comes and starts talking about a Shef Shemaisa that they just learned, or Ktsos, or Rav Chaim, I might not necessarily have covered that in Smicha at YU. So I think that this goes both ways. But what I will say is that I think it's more likely to have a real Toradig conversation, Toradig in the Orthodox term, with people within the Orthodox community broadly defined, than it is within people outside of it broadly defined. More often than not, conversations outside of it are more about, I'm using vague technically, not vague as an attack, but more about vague values than about Dafka Torah concepts. And that's for, I think, various different reasons. And it's not something that everyone has, but it's certainly something that that I've noticed. I wouldn't necessarily use the same words as Moshe did about like the Geshmak and the specific learning tools, because I think that really does differ even within Orthodoxy from where you're going to have. But I think having Torah-centric conversations where everything else is really the tofel to the ikkar of Torah, I think that more often than not is contained within within Orthodox spaces. And that doesn't mean there's nothing to value from conversations outside of it. It just means that, you know, when I'm in a space that's largely non-Orthodox, so I will need to translate terms more, I will need to be more mindful that there's a halakhic concepts that I know in all of their technicalities that that other people do not, and that these things will often just slip their minds and slip my mind, and it's something that we need to work on.
Moshe, it looked like you had what to say, if you want to go ahead first.
I was just going to say, you know, I think I've been very cynical tonight. We were told that that people didn't want just one monologue this time, that we were supposed to debate, so someone had to do that. But I just want to say something I really appreciate when you're in a non-Orthodox space, I have to turn around positive, like you said, Alana, is we alluded to academia. You know, even in Orthodoxy, on the more open fringes of it, like with Koren doing their Land of Israel Chumash, they still have to dance around and make sure that they don't insinuate anything that could be heretical. And they're like, they're playing a game over here. It's precarious. What I appreciate is once you're already in a space where they don't have to adhere to certain beliefs, academia, I'm just going to say it as it is, it's very hard for academia, especially of a biblical and analytical nature, to fully flourish in an Orthodox space, because in the end of the day, you have to come to certain conclusions or you can't come to certain conclusions. So I think the advantage that people who are operating outside of a belief and having the strict tenets that we have gives them the advantage of more free inquiry, which honestly, that's the point of academia. So I think there's something to that. And I just wanted to mention that because I know you brought that up, Alana.
I'm not sure if I fully understood the question correctly now that I'm thinking about what I'm going to say, but I'm going to say it anyway and you'll tell me if it didn't. Great. The way that I teach Torah text is a little bit different from what I've observed as a student in a shiur, in that oftentimes the source sheets that I prepare will have fewer sources on them. They will have some that are more commonly known and some that are more obscure. Intentionally, so that everyone will have a touch point somewhere in there and can say, oh, this is something that I know, or oh, this is something that I don't know. And I think that there's something really important about that. Torah, as has been said multiple times, is the common language amongst Jewish people, and it's something that we can all talk about together, regardless of your background, regardless of where you're coming from, regardless of who you identify as today. And the more that we can make that the touch point in the center of all of our conversation, the more likelihood we have to really feel that unity and feel that we can actually have what to converse about together. And I think that that's really important. Having taught students from various different backgrounds, whether it be at Bicultural now in the high school I'm teaching at, or in other contexts on NCSY trips that are pulling students from various different backgrounds as well, or birthright trips where people are coming from all over the place. Torah is definitely something that should be part of the conversation. Text is not something that should be shied away from at all. In fact, I think it is integral to be included in there. And also, I think if we leave things just as a text-based conversation, we are losing out on much of what the text has to offer and much of what we can gain from those Torah conversations.
Well, Alana, I think that's an upbeat note for us to leave it on. We are 2 minutes from 9 o'clock and no one has their hands raised. So Alana, first of all, I just want to thank you for your time, your expertise, your life experience, your insights. It's great to see you. Ironically, you're in Stanford every day, but we get to see each other only on Zoom, I suppose. Stephen, you as well. And Yair, posthumously, I guess. Yasher Koach, everyone, for your time. And thank you to everyone who logged on to listen, partake in this discussion. I see there's an entire Megillah in the chat for me to read most of it that I missed. But I think I speak for all of us that we put this conversation out there, not just to limit it to this 1 hour / hour and a half. But we hope that you guys continue this conversation. And certainly, I think each of us, Alana, Stephen, and Yair, we're all happy to continue the conversation with you guys. You can reach out to us. Please don't spam our inboxes that much, but we're more than happy to schmooze with each and every one of you. Would you guys Alana wants to be spammed. Okay. Have a wonderful evening. And by the way,
either tonight or tomorrow, we will be posting a feedback form. Please fill it out if you want to suggest future topics.
Yes.
If you want us to do this again, if you have any ha'aras at all that you'd like us to hear, please fill that out when we post it.
Apparently, sexism is our next one, I think. Are we allowed to have 3 men and 1 woman in them? That's the question. Okay. We'll talk. Have a good night, everyone. Good night.